iDrive SoCal is brought to you by the very best auto retailers from across Southern California. When it's time for you to buy or even just kick the tires on the idea of buying, just go to iDriveSoCal.com and click on dealers. iDriveSoCal.com, click on dealers, and get connected. Now, on with the podcast.
It's a automotive museum designed to allow us to showcase the history of the automobile, the industry itself, and the artistry of the automobile on many different levels in a number of different galleries in rotating showcases. So from Hollywood film cars to Starz cars to exotic Bentleys and Bugattis, Delahays, back to 1912 Detroit electric cars, something for everybody, really. We were voted world's best automotive museum last year. That, we talk about the industry and the world. Nobody does what we do. There's an automotive revolution going on right now that we need to be a part of. But I also believe that people will still want to drive cars.
Welcome to iDrive SoCal, the podcast all about mobility from the automotive capital of the United States, Southern California. And today's podcast is quite special because with Southern California being the capital of the automotive world, we're in the Capitol building right now at Peterson Automotive Museum. And joining me is the executive director of the Peterson Automotive Museum, Terry Cargas. Terry, thank you so much for joining me.
Afternoon. Glad to be here.
First, can you please give me a highline overview of the Peterson Automotive Museum, which I and so many other people absolutely love?
Well, it's a automotive museum designed to allow us to showcase the history of the automobile, the industry itself, and the artistry of the automobile on many different levels in a number of different galleries in rotating showcases. So from Hollywood film cars to Starz cars to exotic Bentleys and Bugattis, Delahays, back to 1912 Detroit electric cars, something for everybody, really. And then there's the vault, which is downstairs here, which is one of the most famous parts of any automotive museum in the world, where we take you on a 90-minute tour of things that and give you a great story behind most of the cars.
And I'm smiling right now because I've never been in the vault. And when security first sent us down here for the interview, my colleague and I took a left when we were supposed to take a right.
A detour,
because we saw the vault. We're like, oh.
Yeah.
So cool.
And it's actually, we're about to completely overhaul the vault. We're going to do a major renovation in there and add another 60,000 square feet to the vault with another 200 cars. So the tour will be what I believe to be the most important or best automotive tour, guided tour anywhere in the world.
So the museum itself is like any museum and an art museum. You're going to have exhibits that come and go.
Correct.
You guys do that too.
You bet. Every year, each of our galleries changes out every year, but they're rotating in various times. So there's always something new to see. You could come four or five times a year and see something new.
And how do you expand the vault? Are you going down further?
There's 60,000 square feet of space that right now is storage space. Oh. We're going to convert that into showcase space and bring in an additional, say, 200 cars, of very special cars, but by country or origin of France, Germany, British, American muscle. We have a motorsports section, Japanese cars, Italian cars. Kind of a world tour, if you will.
I want to get to you on a personal level in just a minute, find out how you got this awesome job. But before we do, a couple of trivia things. What is the single most expensive or highly valued vehicle that has been in here in the museum or currently is?
There are probably several crown jewels that we have in our collection. Among them, you know, the round door rolls, the Henry Ford owned Barchetta Ferrari that he got from Enzo in 1952 when they were still lovers. And there are several others. The Rita Hayworth Ghia Cadillac that her boyfriend gave her, but the one that is, let's say, the most expensive and probably considered the most valuable, certainly by the auction houses, is the Steve McQueen Jaguar XKSS.
And what's the price tag on that?
That would depend on who's in the room on the day, but it could be a $30, $40 million car.
What's the whole collection? And I'm sure not everything is yours. Some things are on consignment at various times, right?
Again, depending on the day, it's $150 million in the... If it were 175, I wouldn't be surprised, but that's a lot of millions and a lot of cars. Not all of the cars are considered to be extraordinarily valuable, but even if they're not, say, extraordinarily costly, they're certainly beautiful in so many different ways.
Well, there's a cool factor, and cars are different things to different people and bring different, like a song. Like a song brings you back to a certain time. You see a certain car that might not be extraordinarily high value by market standards, but, you know, oh, that's the car that reminds me of this and whatnot in my life. How did you wind up as the executive director of this very, very cool institution?
Would you start when I was a boy in Chicago with my dad going to the first car show, or my granddad taking me to a midget race when I was maybe five in Joliet at the high school stadium, and they were on the dirt track.
So racing got you.
We went to the very first race at Riverside Raceway in 1957 and went to most all the road races out there. And I can remember being struck by the industry part of it. I thought, I don't know that I'm a driver, but I like the idea that all these corporations are here sponsoring this, and that there might be a future for me in that.
And then what did that future look like going into your professional career?
Well, I got married as a young man and had three children by the time I was 24. So working two, three jobs to pay the bills. I ended up working at Disneyland. I was there for 4 years, and then I went to SeaWorld for 4 years. And then I went to Marine World San Francisco for 4 years. So I had a good entertainment background about how to move bodies into and through a gate, sell tickets. But I was bored to tears. And I had decided right then that I needed to be involved with cars, but at what level and where and how. And so I bought a race car. Wouldn't you think? I mean, wouldn't that be the immediate?
Yeah. With a wife and kids and multiple jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, race car. That's the logical next step, I think.
Good investment.
Yeah,
good investment.
Absolutely.
Logical. But I found
still
out.
Married, by the way?
Oh, yeah. I found out almost immediately that I wasn't fast enough. I wasn't wealthy enough. And I didn't want to race in amateur racing. So I wondered I don't want to get out of this. I need to be involved. What can I do? And in the theme park business, I had learned how to sell sponsorships to shows and exhibits and things. So I went and introduced myself to teams. And the thing that that's obvious in racing is that the common denominator is everyone needs money. They need sponsorships. And in fact, there's a funny story. I introduced myself to Roger Penske one day at the Long Beach Grand Prix. And I said, "Mr. Penske, I want to tell you how much I have admired the way you have raced through the years. You've always done it right. You've always had the right amount of money to do it." He said, "That shows how little you know about racing, kid." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "There's never been enough money to do it right."
So did you basically go in from a marketing perspective and create an opportunity for yourself in connecting race teams with money, sponsorship money?
That was the common denominator is that everybody needs money. So I thought, okay, I know how to sell. I know how to sell sponsorships. I'm passionate about racing. I can do this. So I started that.
And then from there, here?
I ended up doing some consulting work with some guys. But I got a call one day, "Would you ever thought about coming over to the museum?" And I said no. It had never crossed my mind. And I'd only been to the museum a couple of times and really wasn't knocked over.
So the state of the museum is absolutely gorgeous on the outside and the inside. You guys really don't have a competition per se in this space, and correct me if I'm wrong, but talk a little bit about your contemporaries. Who does the Peterson Automotive Museum look at and say, "Hey, that's a good idea. We can do it this way here."
Well, it's the contemporaries. It's interesting. We were voted world's best automotive museum last year. And that's in competition with Porsche, BMW, Ferrari, Mercedes-Benz. We were voted world's best, though, because not because those aren't brilliant museums. They're spectacular by any imagination, but they're a specific brand.
Right.
It's one. You're talking about one brand. We talk about the industry and the world. Nobody does what we do. No one does what we do in telling the story in so many different ways.
So you guys don't really have an equal. You are, pun intended, you're creating the wheel.
Exactly. And that's the opportunity and the challenge and the fun and what keeps you up at night. You know, how do you show cars and tell stories? We've got panel discussions on valuing cars, on, you know, preserving your collection. We're starting a new program called Drivers of Change, which is all about the future mm-hmm. of the automotive world. Mm-hmm. And we'll produce Pete Talks, which will be like TED Talks, but 15 minutes. With experts in a field talking about what is the future of the automobile, what's the future of mobility. And part of that is because we're a history museum, but there's an automotive revolution going on right now that we need to be a part of. So we're not the voice of that. We're the collector, but for that, we can be a forum for the topic, for what's being talked about. We're doing a teen mechanical institute, teaching kids how to work on cars. And, you know, with the idea that, and I'm stealing this from a good friend of ours, Jonathan Ward at Icon, came up with a phrase that he's trying to decriminalize blue collar work. You know, we want to show kids that you can work on really cool cars, make a great living, and have fun doing it.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to college to do that, but come on in here.
You touched on mobility and the future. What does it look like? Is it going to be all electric cars in the museum? Is gas and diesel, are those going to be like one floor, one area? Like, oh, back in the day, we actually used to put these fluids in the cars to make them go somewhere.
I think that part of that, or part of all of what you just said, is true, or is accurate about what the future will be. A lot of kids don't even care about having a driver's license today,
right?
But that's not all of them. And there are oil companies who disagree that it's going to be all electric quickly. You're not going to have quick charge stations on every corner like you have gas stations. And the most important thing about Americans is the ability to move themselves wherever they want to, whenever they want to, as quickly as they want to. And that is facilitated by an energy supply. And when you consider that we have a long way to go for infrastructure with electric cars, if a car can go 300 miles, that's one thing today. Technology is moving so fast now that who knows how much style and interest is a pod going to have that moves around electrically? I don't know. I think that we'll have those. Bob Lutz says that the car industry is done. It's finished. It's everything has changed. And in 20 years, we're not going to know. I think he's right.
Podcast listeners, Bob Lutz is a legendary car guy that's responsible for.
Oh, God. Pontiac was his baby. He was a hot rodder and one of the real, real pioneer car guys in the Detroit Big Three. Fighter pilot, a real maverick, a man who's always spoken his piece. And he made a speech a little bit ago that said the car industry is dead. But at the same time, Keith Crane at Automotive News, who arguably has the ear of gets to listen to every major automotive mm-hmm. manufacturer chieftain mm-hmm. in the world, is also saying, wait a minute. Everybody's talking about electric and driverless cars, autonomous cars. Who says so? Who's declared that? But all these companies are betting huge everything. They're betting the barn on electric and autonomous. So, and the public has bought into it too. So that might be not having a barrier to entry on that, like so many other industries do. When you start a new product or you're changing and something as dramatic as this, That doesn't seem to be the case. People are clamoring for electric cars. But right now they're being subsidized. I don't know that anybody really knows what things look like in 30 years. I do know that the cars that we have now are incredibly beautiful, at least the historic cars. It's not necessarily a museum position that museums take. Theirs is, you know, a Monet is beautiful. You don't have to go to work on it. But we're putting cars on podiums and presenting them as rolling sculpture. So how do we tell the story around that? Because technology itself right now is largely a singular user, and museum experience isn't a single person. You're in groups when you come in. We learned that when we opened the new museum. We have a lot of tech, very, very techy stuff that doesn't get used because it's a singular experience, and the visitors are in groups.
You touched on the pods. Share some of the realistic or wild-eyed theories of what the future is going to look like, not necessarily in the museum, but out on the roads.
Well, you know, I think as technology continues to change things, it will continue to change things that much more quickly. There's some property being developed in Palo Alto up in Silicon Valley right now in a shopping area that doesn't have any parking. And they asked the developer why, and said, well, because they're not going to need it. They're going to get dropped off.
Right. I did a podcast with a guy who is head of a nonprofit called New Cities, and they did a recent conference about the future of mobility here in the Arts District. And John Rassant is his name.
Oh, sure. L.A. Commotion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And he theorized that when the Olympics are here in 10 years, that you'll fly into LAX. You'll be picked up by a driverless taxi. We'll take you to your hotel, and you say, for instance, you need to get you know, downtown or to the Coliseum more quickly. You'll take the flying driverless taxi that is be provided by the joint venture between Uber and NASA, and take that to and from the Coliseum back to your hotel, and then the driverless taxi back to LAX, and then LAX back out of town. What do you think about any of that?
I was at Disneyland when Walt Disney was building Epcot.
Yep.
I was fortunate enough to my father-in-law was one of Walt's right-hand guys.
Oh, wow.
So I got to see some things behind the scenes. And the design that they had was Epcot was the experimental prototype city of tomorrow.
Right.
But they had all these flying things and aerial, you know, highways and underground passageways. And they're still driving cars and trucks and delivering food, you know, 50 years later. The difference... John has a vision, and John's a very, very bright guy. Whether you can forecast, let me put it this way. If I'm around for the Olympics, I'm going to drive my car down and find a parking spot. I'll give it to a valet so I don't have to hunt for the space and be comfortable.
It's an exciting thing to think about, whatever direction we wind up going.
Think of the automotive industry is only about 145, 146 years old. Think of where we've come. I mean, you look at Henry Ford's first cars and the first race cars and the things that have evolved since then. I think it will evolve more quickly now into something new and different. But I also believe that people will still want to drive cars. It may become a luxury item that only the wealthy or people who are interested are pursuing, but there will be cars built by people who want to drive them.
Drive them themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning I want my hands on some kind of thing that controls the direction it goes.
Absolutely.
To, and probably my feet on mechanisms that make it go and stop.
The joy of commanding a vehicle, whether at speed or just along the open highway, is a joy. a top-down drive on PCH on a sunny day, it might be better if you were in a pod. But I personally enjoy driving around corners and, you know, maybe speeding a little bit when where it's safe. But those are pleasures that may fade away too as the world and technology evolves.
Well, I personally could not get my driver's license fast enough, and I can't. I just had a son, so 16 years from now. If we're still getting our driver's license when we're 16 years from now, I wonder, is he, I'm going to impart, you know, my love for cars and driving with him. But, you know, as you point out earlier, you know, kids these days seem to have their sense of freedom in the mobile devices that they all carry around.
My granddaughter was 22. She still didn't have a license. I said, okay, here's the deal. You're out of the family. I have a 15 and a half year old grandson who's about to get his learner's permit, and he can't get in a car fast enough. In fact, I'm looking at buying an old clunker four speed so I can teach them all how to drive a stick shift.
What's a clutch, Grandpa?
Yeah, right. Why do you have to do this? Can't you just go?
Well, Terry, I heard your alarm going off. I know I've taken more time than I was allotted.
My pleasure.
This is iDrive SoCal. That was the executive director of the Peterson Automotive Museum here in Los Angeles, California, Terry Cargas. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Until next time. This episode of iDrive SoCal was engineered by Micah Palmquist and J-Dubs produced on site.